Life is unpredictable, but preparing for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. They offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com. That's PolicyGenius.com.
So, what do Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, Nat King Cole, and believe it or not, Batman, all have in common? It sounds like a setup for a pretty strange joke, but the answer is actually Riddle.
Right.
Nelson Riddle.
Nelson Smock Riddle Jr., yeah. An incredible figure.
Absolutely. Today, we're doing a real deep dive into the life and, frankly, the indelible legacy of this man, the arranger, the composer, band leader, orchestrator. I mean, his sound really shaped American popular music, didn't it? From the late 40s right through the 80s.
Oh, completely. When you hear that sophisticated swing, those, you know, sweeping strings or that really punchy, exciting brass, chances are you're hearing Nelson Riddle's work, that meticulously crafted sound.
Exactly. So our mission today isn't just to list his credits, right? We want to really unpack his journey. I mean, this is a guy whose arrangements didn't just back up legends.
No, often they made them legends. That's the key. We need to explore those formative moments of things that really lit the fire for him.
And dissect those big collaborations, like with Sinatra and Cole. How did they actually work? Why were they so successful?
Right. And how did he navigate such a rapidly changing music scene? You know, adapting his talent without sort of selling out his artistic vision.
And then there's that incredible comeback later in his life. Just amazing.
Totally unexpected. So by the end of this, you should really get why he's considered such a giant. An architect of sound, really. His craft, his innovation. It still resonates today.
Okay, let's start at the beginning then. Nelson Smock Riddle Jr., born June 1st, 1921, Oradell, New Jersey. But his family background, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Might hint at the musical diversity to come.
Yeah, his mother, Marie Albertine, was of French and Spanish descent. His father, Nelson Smock Sr., had English, Irish, and Dutch roots. It's quite a mix.
It is. Do you think that blend, that sort of cultural mosaic, maybe subconsciously gave him a broader musical ear early on?
It's possible, isn't it? Not necessarily specific melodies, but maybe just an openness, a flexibility, being exposed, even subtly, to different cultural rhythms or sensibilities in the home.
Could be. I might have laid some groundwork for fusing, you know, classical structure with jazz or big band with Latin rhythms later on.
Exactly. Less about direct influence, more about cultivating a broad, adaptable musical mind. And there's another layer, too. Quite poignant, actually. He was an only surviving child.
Oh, wow. I read his mother had endured multiple miscarriages and a stillbirth.
Six miscarriages and one stillbirth, yeah. That kind of history.
Yeah.
It can sometimes instill a real singular focus, can it? Sense of purpose, maybe even before he picked up an instrument, a certain weight.
You can sort of feel that drive, that deliberate path when you look at how his musical spark ignited. It wasn't just casual.
No, definitely not. His father's interest was key. Piano lessons at 8, then trombone at 14.
Yeah.
That feels very intentional.
And his high school, Ridgewood High, apparently really encouraged his music. It wasn't just a hobby.
Right. But what really pushed him, what made him commit, it wasn't just lessons. There was this pivotal moment, wasn't there?
Yes. The Bolero moment.
Exactly. Hearing Serge Koussevitzky conduct the Boston Symphony Orchestra playing Ravel's Bolero, his description of it is just electric.
He said, it's almost as if the orchestra leaped from the stage and smacked you in the face.
Incredible imagery. It wasn't just hearing music. It was physical, visceral. It was the power of the orchestration itself. Ravel's genius in layering instruments, building that immense crescendo.
The meticulous architectural approach to sound.
That's what hit him. The sheer potential of arrangement and orchestration. It showed him what was possible, the impact you could have. One piece of music redirecting a whole life.
An orchestra smacking you in the face.
Yeah, you can see how that would shift things. Because initially, he wanted to be a performer, right?
A jazz trombone player, yeah.
He was focused on playing.
But then he had this moment of, well, honest self-assessment. He said, I didn't have the coordination.
Right. And instead of giving up, this perceived weakness, this limitation, actually pushed him towards arranging and composing.
It's fascinating how that works, isn't it? A perceived flaw leading to a completely different, maybe even greater, strength and path.
Absolutely. And that new path got a huge boost from early influences and mentorship. The family had a summer home in Rumson, New Jersey.
Right. And he actually convinced his parents to let him finish his senior year there in 1938. already steering his own course.
Definitely. And it was there, playing in a local band, the Brigadiers, that he met Bill Finnegan.
Ah, Finnegan. Only 4 years older, but Riddle said he was considerably more musically sophisticated.
Yeah. Finnegan became a really important early mentor. His influence wasn't just theoretical. It directly shaped Riddle's arranging style as it was developing.
How so? What did Finnegan show him?
Well, more advanced harmonies, probably. Intricacies of voicing for different sections, how to craft arrangements that really enhanced a melody, not just accompanied it. It shows how crucial that early exposure to higher level skills can be.
And you can see the results pretty quickly, can't you? By the mid-40s, he's already doing arrangements for big names.
Exactly. Glenn Miller's Little Brown Jug, that was one of his early ones, infusing it with that rhythmic precision.
And jazz arrangements for Tommy Dorsey, like Chloe and At Sundown, these weren't simple charts.
No, they showed a real understanding of swing dynamics, brass voicings, string textures. The hallmarks were already there. It was rapid development building that foundation.
So moving into his professional years, his late teens and early 20s sound like a whirlwind, playing trombone, arranging for local dance bands.
Culminating with the Charlie Spivak Orchestra. That was significant. It wasn't just playing, it was intense practical experience, learning the mechanics of a big band, blending sections, creating dynamics live, a real apprenticeship.
And all this while the world's at war. He joins the Merchant Marine in 43, serves 2 years.
But still manages to work with Spivak somehow, and incredibly, continues studying orchestration.
With Alan Shulman, another merchant mariner who is also a composer, how did he even manage that?
It speaks volumes about his dedication, doesn't it? That relentless drive to learn, no matter the circumstances. Shulman was a serious composer, blending classical and jazz elements. That knowledge would have been invaluable.
Deepening his understanding of counterpoint, harmony, instrumental color, stuff he'd use constantly later.
Absolutely. Then, after the Merchant Marine, he steps up again, joining Tommy Dorsey's orchestra in 44. Third trombone. That's the big leagues.
Right. Dorsey's band was known for its precision, another masterclass.
But then the Army calls in April 45. He serves 15 months. World War II just kept interrupting things.
But he didn't waste a second after discharge, did he? June 46, he's out, and boom, straight to Hollywood.
Knew exactly where he needed to be, focused on arranging.
And it paid off fast. By May 49, he's got a hit. Doris Day, again, reached number 2.
That was a big breakthrough. His arrangement was lush, sophisticated, really complimented her voice, but didn't overwhelm it. Tasteful restraint. It signaled his arrival.
And that success leads directly to another pivotal moment, maybe the pivotal moment, the Nat King Cole connection.
Right. 1950, Les Baxter at Capitol hires Riddle to arrange for Cole. Cole's transitioning from jazz trio to solo star.
And Riddle arranges Mona Lisa,
which becomes Cole's biggest single ever, a massive hit, cements Cole's crossover appeal.
But the fascinating part, the real aha moment, is he gets no credit initially. It's all attributed to Baxter.
Isn't that wild? But Cole apparently heard that sound, knew it wasn't just Baxter, and found out who actually did it. He specifically sought Riddle out after that.
Wow. So an uncredited arrangement sparks one of the most legendary partnerships in music. The sound itself was the calling card.
Precisely. And Riddle understood collaboration. That same year, 1950, he connects with Vern Yoakam.
His right hand for 30 years, the copyist and librarian.
Absolutely crucial. You need someone reliable to get those intricate scores perfectly prepped for the musicians. Yoakam ensured Riddle's vision was accurately translated. Couldn't have had that prolific output without him.
Okay, so by 1953, Riddle is clearly a major talent at Capitol, and Sinatra arrives.
Yeah, Sinatra moves from Columbia to Capitol, needing a fresh start. Capitol execs see Riddle as the obvious choice.
But Sinatra resists. He wants to stick with Axel Stordahl, his old arranger.
Initially, yes. Loyalty, maybe, or just comfort with Stordahl's sound, which had defined his crooner image. It makes Riddle's eventual success even more dramatic. He had to win Sinatra over.
When those first Stordahl sessions at Capitol didn't quite click, Sinatra eventually relented. High stakes for both of them.
Huge stakes. Sinatra's career was shaky. Riddle's stepping into massive shoes, needing to reinvent an icon.
And reinvent me did. First session, April 30th, 1953. First song, I've Got the World on a String.
And bam, a runaway hit. It just exploded. Everyone agrees it relaunched Sinatra's career.
Monumental. Two legends defining each other. What was it about that arrangement? What did Riddle do differently from Stordahl?
Stordahl was softer, more strings, almost ethereal. Beautiful, but maybe dated by 53. Riddle brought muscle, but sophisticated muscle. A driving swing rhythm, powerful but precise brass, vibrant woodwinds.
The orchestra wasn't just background anymore.
Exactly. It was an active participant, almost a co-star. It created this excitement, this confidence, this swagger that matched Sinatra's vocal perfectly. Riddle created space around the voice, letting it cut through.
Incredible. And Riddle himself had a favorite Sinatra project, didn't he? Only the Lonely.
Yes, the 1958 ballad album.
Yeah.
One of Sinatra's most successful, critically and commercially.
Why do you think that one resonated so much with Riddle personally?
Well, it was a masterpiece of mood, pure atmosphere, a concept album about heartbreak. Riddle's arrangements were sparse, but incredibly rich emotionally. Melancholy strings, muted brass, specific instrumental colors, painting this landscape of sadness.
Total restraint, but amplifying the vocal.
Perfectly. It showed his depth, not just the swing side. He could evoke complex emotions with such subtlety. You could see why he'd be proud of that level of artistry, where every note served the emotional core.
A true symbiosis. And the next decade, his output is just staggering. He's not just doing Sinatra and Cole.
No, the list is incredible. Kate Smith, Judy Garland, Dean Martin, Peggy Lee, Rosemary Clooney, Keeley Smith, So many others at Capitol.
Unbelievable demand, unbelievable versatility. How did he tailor his approach for such different singers?
He was a master of musical psychology, really. For Dean Martin, maybe more relaxed, easygoing swing. For Peggy Lee, something chic, sophisticated, intricate harmonies, highlighting her cool delivery.
And Garland.
He understood her drama, arrangements that soared with her, full orchestral swells matching her intensity, always framing their strengths, elevating their essence, never just applying a formula.
And he wasn't just arranging for others, he was making his own records, too.
Right. Recording his own instrumental discs. He was a star in his own right, Lisbon Antigua, in late 55.
Hits number one in 56 for 4 weeks. What was the magic there?
It was this charming, exotic instrumental, lilting cinematic melody. That Portuguese folk flavor was very popular then. Riddle's arrangement was impeccable, shimmering strings, crisp rhythm. It just captured the public's imagination.
Showed people loved his sound, even without a singer.
Exactly. They were drawn to his aesthetic, his flair for melody. And he had successful LPs, too, hey? Let Yourself Go, Kemen. Get Happy. Both hit the top 20.
And then the Grammy win. 1959, first Grammy ceremony for Cross Country Suite.
Best musical composition over 5 minutes. Composed for clarinetist Buddy DeFranco. This was huge.
Absolutely. Showed his skill went way beyond arranging existing songs. He was a serious composer with ambition.
Definitely. Cross Country Suite was a multi-movement work, exploring complex themes and textures. It proved his peers respected him as an original creative voice, not just a brilliant interpreter.
And his reach kept expanding. Film work took off too, collaborating with Conrad Salinger at MGM.
For that first Crosby-Sinatra duet in high society, imagine orchestrating that moment.
Incredible. And scoring Pal Joey in 57. Plus, TV, he and his orchestra were regulars on the Rosemary Clooney Show.
He was becoming ubiquitous. His sound was everywhere.
And then the Ella Fitzgerald collaborations in the early 60s really cemented his status, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. Those 1962 albums, Ella Swings Brightly and Ella Swings Gently, and his work on her later songbook albums for Jerome Kern and Johnny Mercer.
Just perfect settings for her voice.
He provided the ideal harmonic and rhythmic frameworks, supportive but inspiring, allowing her agility and depth to shine. It kept that whole Great American Songbook vibrant, really.
So moving into the 60s, things start shifting again. He follows Sinatra to Reprise Records in 63.
Right. Staying aligned with his key collaborator, working under Morris Stoloff there. But he doesn't just stay in that lane. He starts exploring.
The Tom Jobim Partnership. 1964. That leads to the wonderful world of Antonio Carlos Jobim.
Yeah, diving into bossa nova shows his willingness to embrace new international sounds, proving his arrangements could work in almost any genre. His influence was going global.
Okay, but then comes the biggest surprise, maybe. The Caped Crusader. How does the guy who arranged Sinatra end up doing Batman?
Huh. It's wild, isn't it? In 1966, William Dozier hires him for the Adam West Batman TV series.
Neil Hefti did the famous theme song.
Right, but Riddle did all the incidental music. The background score for the first two seasons and the movie. He created the sound world of Gotham.
All the pows and zaps orchestrated by Nelson Riddle. It's mind-blowing.
It really is. And you could hear the influence bleed over. His score for the John Wayne film El Dorado, also in 66, had that Batman-esque, brassy, punchy feel. Cross-pollination.
Shows his incredible versatility. Adapting his orchestral skill to something totally different, can't be even, but still sounding like him somehow.
Exactly. He used sharp staccato brass, fanfares, dissonant harmonies, dynamic shifts to match the action and the comedy. He made the music as witty and exaggerated as the show itself.
And his TV work kept going strong. Themes for Route 66, The Untouchables, The Rogues, musical director for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour.
And more film scores, Robin and the Seven Hoods, the original Ocean's 11, Rat Pack Central.
And then Paint Your Wagon in 69, making non-singers like Lee Marvin and Clint Eastwood sound, while listenable.
A true testament to his arranging magic. Weaving their, let's say, limited vocals into something cohesive and enjoyable. Sheer technical wizardry.
But even as he's having all the success, that main partnership, the Sinatra one, starts to cool off a bit in the late 60s.
Yeah, it becomes more distant. Sinatra starts using other arrangers more frequently, like Don Costa, Billy May.
Why the shift, do you think? What did Costa and May offer that was different?
Well, it reflects Sinatra's own desire to stay current. Costa brought a more contemporary pop sound, maybe harder hitting, using more electric instruments, reflecting rock and soul influences.
And Billy May.
May was also a big band guy, but his style was maybe looser, brassier, more overtly swinging than Riddle's polished elegance. Sinatra was exploring different vibes.
So Strangers in the Night in 66 was their last full album project together, though Riddle still did arrangements for him later.
Right. And significantly, the title track, the huge hit Strangers in the Night, wasn't arranged by Riddle. It was Ernie Freeman.
Ah, signaling that shift. Freeman's arrangement had that more immediate rock-tinged energy.
Exactly. Maybe something Riddle wouldn't have approached quite the same way. It was definitely a period of transition for Riddle, navigating a changing landscape.
And that leads to a difficult moment. By 1970, he's without a recording contract for the first time in over 25 years.
Yeah, his Liberty Records contract had ended a couple of years prior. Imagine that uncertainty after decades of constant work. Must have been challenging.
How does someone like him handle that? He flies to London, records Riddle. Nelson Riddle conducts the 101 strings.
But it doesn't quite land, does it? His biographer, Peter Levinson, described him as out of his depth, trying to fuse contemporary and classical there.
Why do you think that project misfired? Was it just chasing trends?
Possibly. He was trying to blend his orchestral style with, you know, maybe synths or pop rhythms that felt unnatural to him. The fusion felt forced, lacking that organic sophistication of his best work. It shows even masters have experiments that don't quite work out, but they keep pushing.
And he definitely kept pushing, because recognition continued. The 1970s saw major highlights. He finally wins the Oscar.
Yes, for The Great Gatsby score in 1974, after five previous nominations. A huge, deserved win, capturing that whole era musically.
Plus, more TV success. Musical director for the Julie Andrews Hour, winning an Emmy for that. Themes for Emergency and Carib. Scoring the 7th Avenue miniseries, his orchestra was still performing live, too.
He remained very active. And there were those final, poignant collaborations with Sinatra, too.
Right. March 77, arranging for that never-completed album of songs with women's names, Nancy, Emily, Linda.
Some of which eventually surfaced, like Sweet Lorraine, and he was musical director for the 50th Academy Awards in 78, his only time doing that prestigious gig.
Still contributing to Sinatra albums like Trilogy and She Shot Me Down into the early 80s.
And that final time working together, conducting for Sinatra at Reagan's inaugural gala in January 85. A very public capstone.
And a final project with Ella Fitzgerald too, right? The best is yet to come in 1982.
Her last orchestral album on Pablo Records. It underscores that enduring respect. Even as trends changed, the legend still trusted him implicitly to provide the perfect setting. His standard held.
Which sets the stage for maybe the most unexpected chapter of all. The comeback.
Absolutely. Spring 1982, Linda Ronstadt, huge rise star, reaches out via her manager, Peter Asher. She wants Nelson Riddle to arrange an album of jazz standards for her.
Just wild. A radical idea for a rock singer back then. The music world must have been stunned.
Completely. And Riddle himself was skeptical, wasn't he?
Very. He knew her name, obviously, but apparently basically hated rock and roll. Wasn't exactly her target demographic.
No. But that great anecdote about his daughter, a Ronstadt fan, reassuring him.
Don't worry, Dad. Her checks won't bounce. Just perfect. Humanizes the whole thing. Practical consideration.
It does. But once he considered it seriously, he brought his full artistic integrity to bear. He insisted. A complete album or nothing.
And gave that great reason, comparing a single arrangement in a rock album to putting a picture in a bad frame. The mood has to be consistent.
Exactly. It shows his commitment to thematic coherence. He wasn't just arranging songs. He was building an atmosphere, a whole sonic world. He needed the entire gallery, not just one framed picture.
And that commitment paid off spectacularly, despite skepticism even from her record label, President Joe Smith,
who feared alienating her rock fans with what Rundstedt herself called elevator music.
They got a 3-album contract, and those albums, What's New, Lush Life, for sentimental reasons,
sold over 7 million copies combined. It wasn't just a success, it was a phenomenon.
A truly game-changing collaboration. Redefined careers, bridged genres, changed music history. It's incredible.
Absolutely. It revitalized Rundstedt's career, gave her a new direction, and brought Riddle roaring back into the spotlight for his final years.
And won him 2 more Grammys, What's New and Lush Life.
Right. The third one, for Lush Life, awarded posthumously, accepted by Rundstedt with that moving tribute. But the impact was even bigger than sales or awards.
Stephen Holden at the New York Times called What's New the best and most serious attempt to rehabilitate an idea of pop that Beatlemania undid in the mid-60s.
That's huge. He's talking about how rock had pushed the great American songbook Porter, Gershwin, Kern to the margins.
Relegated it to easy listening.
Exactly. What's New was the first album by a major rock singer to bring that songbook back to the forefront commercially of a massive cultural reevaluation.
A profound legacy. Bridging generations, proving timeless songs and sophisticated arrangements could still captivate a contemporary audience. It opened doors for so many others.
All thanks to Riddle's exquisite work and Rundstedt's brave vision. And Riddle had that powerful final public appearance conducting at the presidential inaugural gala in January 85. Sinatra singing, Baryshnikov dancing. Quite a moment.
And one last major project, arranging for opera singer Kiri Takanawa just months before his death, creating right to the very end.
He really did. A life dedicated to the art form.
And beyond the music, there was a full personal life, too. Married Doreen Moran back in 1945.
Well, still in the army, yeah. They had 7 children together. Nelson III, Maureen, Christopher, Rosemary, Leonora, who died young, Cecily, and Bettina.
A big family. And his eldest son, Nelson III, married Paula Wilcox, the British actress.
Right. But like many lives, it had complexities. The affair with Rosemary Clooney in the 60s.
Which contributed to the breakup of both their marriages. Adds that human dimension, the struggles behind the scenes.
Definitely. He and Doreen separated in 68, divorced in 70. He then married his secretary, Naomi Tenenholtz, later that year.
And they were together for the rest of his life, finding stability later on.
It seemed so. He passed away in L.A. October 6, 1985, age 64. Cardiac and kidney failure due to cirrhosis, diagnosed 5 years earlier.
Buried at Hollywood Forever Cemetery, a fitting place. But the legacy didn't stop. His son Christopher.
An accomplished bass trombonist himself, yeah. He took over leadership of his father's orchestra in 86.
Keeping that sound alive, authentically performed.
Exactly. Preserving the integrity, the spirit of those arrangements for live audiences. It's a wonderful continuation.
And then the educational legacy. After his second wife, Naomi, died, their house sale funded.
The Nelson Riddle Endowed Chair and Library at the University of Arizona opened in 2001, fostering future generations of arrangers and orchestrators.
With Linda Ronstadt performing at the opening gala, such a perfect full circle.
Beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the tributes kept coming. Eric Kunzel and the Cincinnati Pops did that tribute album, Route 66, that Nelson Riddle sound.
Showcasing expanded versions of his arrangements, still inspiring people.
And even TV shows like Newhart, which he scored, dedicated an episode to him. His sound is just woven into the fabric of American culture.
So we've really covered a lot from that initial Ravel inspiration, the mentorships, those huge partnerships with Sinatra, Cole, Ella.
To the iconic film and TV scores, Batman included. And then that incredible Rundstedt collaboration, changing the game all over again.
He wasn't just an arranger, was he? He truly was an architect of sound. Meticulously building these sonic landscapes.
Absolutely. Elevating every performance he touched, leaving this indelible mark.
So what's the big takeaway for you listening today? I think Riddle's story is a powerful reminder, isn't it, that real artistry often happens just outside the spotlight.
Yeah, in the skilled hands shaping the performance. It's about dedication, adaptability, the power of collaboration across genres and generations.
And that you can keep redefining your impact, even late in your career. Sometimes the biggest influence comes from being that master behind the scenes.
That quiet genius underpinning it all.
So maybe a final thought. The next time you hear a classic standard or even a newer artist tackling the Great American Songbook, listen closely.
Can you hear those echoes? That Nelson Riddle genius, still guiding the melody, still defining that sound.
And maybe ask yourself, who are the Nelson Riddles of today? Who are the overlooked masters shaping the music you love, just out of the spotlight, waiting for their own deep dive?
Life is unpredictable, but how you prepare for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. Whether to cover debts and routine expenses, or even invest the money and earn interest over time. With Policy Genius, finding and buying life insurance is simple. You can compare quotes from top insurers and could find coverage that fits your needs and your budget. Plus, they offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. It's an easy way to feel good about and plan for the future. No wonder Policy Genius is the country's leading online insurance marketplace. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com to compare top-rated life insurance policies, get your lowest quote, and make a smart move in under 10 minutes. That's PolicyGenius.com.